committee will come to order. This is the Committee on Commerce and Consumer Protection for Wednesday, April 13th, 2011. Good morning, everyone. Our first bill on the agenda is Senate File 877, Senator Chamberlain.
Mr. Chair, members, first thing here is it's a this is a consumer bill, and again, it's good for competition. So, consumers and competition, it's good for the industry. The industry likes it. The Commerce Department likes it. We do have a couple of amendments. We can do those first. Would you mind?
Senator Chairman, we should certainly do your, if you have an author's amendment, we should do that first, and then you could go through the bill, and there, I understand there are some members with some amendments that we'd probably take up after the explanation.
So the first, I'd like to move, I'm sorry.
The A3?
First, I'd like to move the A3 amendment.
Okay. Members, the A3 amendment, author's amendment's being handed out.
If I could, I'll start explaining this.
Well, let's we'll just adopt the amendment
first,
and then I see that, Senator Chairman, it's a page and line amendment, so it might be a little difficult to follow through somewhat on the explanation of the bill.
Yep.
But you'll have to walk us through that the best you can. So members all should have the A3 amendment, but actually we don't. How many members do we have? We have seven members. We're one shy of a quorum, so I guess we are not going to adopt the A3 amendment. So prior to adopting, why don't you go ahead and let's just start explaining the bill, and we'll have to adopt that amendment. But explain it as if we had adopted it with what your intention is.
Mr. Chair, I'll start out with this brief explanation. It's primarily technical. Conversations that Dominic and Mrs. Rowland have had with the Commerce Department. It addresses DOC's issues, and it's primarily we have concerns that the last issue that involves replacement policies, and that's what this deals with, replacement policies. And we will continue to work with the Department of Commerce to see if it can be resolved before the bill goes to the floor. So these replacement issues, still kind of an ongoing issue, and we're willing to continue working on that issue before it goes to the floor and get it fixed then. Okay?
Okay, well, Senator Chairman, why don't you go ahead and explain the bill then? Your testifiers?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Robin Rowan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council. Senate File 877 is a new NEIC model that is designed to ensure that when a consumer purchases an annuity, that annuity is appropriate for their particular financial circumstances, and it does this in primarily three ways. First, it requires the insurance company to make sure that the sale is suitable, and that's different because current law allows the insurance company to rely on the agent's determination. Not anymore, not under this bill. Two, it provides specific and objective criteria on what makes a sale suitable or appropriate, and that's something we don't have in current law either. And it also enhances agent training on annuity products, so it ensures that they have the knowledge necessary to make these suitability determinations as well. The Department of Commerce has requested several deviations from the national model that we've accommodated, and that is primarily what the A3 amendment is. They gave us one more issue late last week dealing with replacement policies that we have concerns with, but we're continuing to work with them on that one particular issue. I've been asked why we're doing this to ourselves, why we're adding another layer of regulation to what it is that we do in terms of selling annuities, and there's two reasons for that. The first one is that Minnesota is really behind the curve in terms of suitability regulation. 42 other states have more stringent and robust suitability laws than we do. And in addition to that, the SEC has recently been trying to take over the state regulation of fixed annuities. So in the Dodd-Frank bill, they created a safe harbor from the SEC for states that adopt this NAIC model. And by the end of this year, 20 states, including us, if we pass it, will have adopted the NAIC model. And I'd be more than happy to answer Any questions?
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rowan, I think you, maybe for the committee, you might want to talk about what NAIC model is. I know what it is, but I think it would be worth at least talking about what that is.
Sure. So the NAIC is the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, and it's basically a trade association for the regulators, insurance regulators from every state. And they create model laws to help promote uniformity among the states and strong consumer protection laws. And so this is their latest model on annuity suitability.
Okay. Mr. Spezzetto.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dominic Spezzetto, I'm representing the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors Minnesota chapter, which represents about 2,000 life and annuity salespeople throughout the state, and we're here in support of this legislation. Before I get into my testimony very briefly, I'd like to just talk about what suitability is. Suitability is really a standard professional standard that is measured on a particular insurance agent and a company to make sure that the product that they have offered and sold to the individual was suitable for their financial needs. And this generally involves information that the salesperson and the company obtaining information about their financial status, their age, their interest in investments, their experience, and their goals, among others, to assure that the product that is sold to them is suitable for those individuals, considering where they are in life and their finances. And it's a standard that has been throughout the industry. We've had in Minnesota for many, many years. But as Robin said, the standard's been changed since we enacted it several years ago. And so we're kind of catching up to where the rest of the country is. But for the insurance agents, this is a very important piece of legislation in our perspective to avoid possible federal regulation of our activities. As you know, state insurance is regulated at the state level, whereas the activities of the brokerage firms and other financial institutions are regulated at the federal level, and there's been a kind of a fight going on at the federal level over this for many years. And as Robin said, the SEC and the brokerage industry is very interested in getting into the regulation of annuities. However, annuities are an insurance product. And they've made several attempts. In fact, in the Dodd-Frank bill, there were attempts to regulate annuities, but they were unsuccessful, and annuities are not regulated as part of the Dodd-Frank bill, and frankly, were not part of the Wall Street abuses that the bill was aimed at. However, that legislation did create a study relative to the persons that sell annuity products. And again, annuities are sold not only by life insurance salespeople, but also by brokerage firms as well, and how that regulation would work and recommendations necessary to make sure that there is a level playing field or adequate regulation. And the SEC study came back basically saying that the regulation at the state level seems to be working well. However, it did stipulate that in order to assure that this regulation was adequate, that states should adopt this model legislation. And if this model legislation is adopted, we would get sort of a safe harbor from regulation by the SEC for insurance professionals that sell this product. So with that in mind, we're here strongly supporting this legislation and encourage you to pass it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Spezzetto. Senator Chamberlain, anybody else to testify for your bill? Looks like someone from the department. Good morning, Mr. Reich.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. John Reich with the Department of Commerce. Ms. Rowan's statements with respect to our issues on the bill were accurate. We have been in conversation over the last several weeks about some technical changes that our staff at the department had made, and we're able to come to terms on those. There is at this point, another outstanding issue that we're working on, but we are sensitive to the legislative timeline and the fact that next week is break and the following week is deadlines, and so we pledge to continue to work on the bill and to come to some resolution on it. And so just wanted to say that for the record, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator Chamberlain, it's best if we can conclude everything in a bill before we move it along. Yep. We have made some exceptions to that if we're, you know, very sure that it's minor and that it can get taken care of. Is what needs to be taken care of in this bill, is that minor, and you have high confidence that this you'll come to resolution, and that we could avoid a any kind of a long drawn out situation on the floor, because we do want to do the work in the committee, but certainly, of course, when it comes to the floor, if there's just an author's amendment, and or you know, and you can do that there on the floor, that's not a big deal. But I am concerned about moving the bill through without complete resolution on the matter. So can you assure us, the rest of the committee, on where you're at on that?
Mr. Chair, high level of confidence that it'll be resolved before then and be no trouble on the floor.
Okay. All right. Let's see. I thought maybe Mr. Franzman was going to jump up to say something on the bill. I'm sorry?
To an amendment.
Okay. We haven't gotten there yet. Okay, is there anybody else that would like to speak on this bill, either for it? Is there anybody that wants to speak against this bill? Okay, then I understand that some members have some amendments. Is that correct? Or not? There are two. You're saying there's two amendments. Why don't you, we still don't have a member. We're going to have to, if we don't have another member here soon, we're just going to lay this over and take a vote in a little while after all the testimony. But I don't know the status of the amendments, if or who's offering them. Are these?
Mr. Chair, we can take them as an author's amendment. They're A3 and A4, and I understand we can pick them up later once we have a quorum.
Okay. So do you want to speak to the A4 amendment that's being handed out? You already spoke on the A3. Do you want to speak to the A4 amendment? You're saying that this is also an author's amendment as well?
Yes, we'll take it as an author's amendment. We will speak to that now. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Franzen will.
Mr. Franzen, to the A4 amendment.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Doug Franzen. I'm representing Allstate. The A4 amendment is as simple as it is non-controversial. It simply brings Minnesota in line with the rest of the country by permitting the combination of coverages of life and critical illness and hospital indemnity, those types of coverages. The proponents of the bill, Ms. Rowan, is, I don't know if it's supportive or non-objective, highly enthusiastic about the amendment, Mr. Chairman. I think that enthusiasm is shared by the Department of Commerce. Minnesota is one of two states, I believe, I'm not sure, that don't permit this combination. And I'm not sure because the other state is Virginia, which both bodies of the legislature have passed, and I don't know if the Virginia governor has signed the legislation. So quite simply, this is non-controversial, pro-consumer, pro-competition, and it puts Minnesota in line with the other 49 states in the United States. I'd stand for questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Franzen, line 1.16, can you give me a rough idea what you're talking about, other limited benefit health coverage? I just want to have that clear in my mind.
Basically, a limited health care, Mr. Chairman, Senator Gazelka, it's sometimes you see the type of policy on television where it's basically if a health issue occurs, there is a specific benefit. It's a $10,000 coverage, period. You see that type of coverage on the television with the duck a lot, quacking. It's sometimes it takes the form of hospital coverage, sometimes it's disease specific, but I think 1.16 is mostly generic language, so it's not too limiting.
Okay. Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, can you tell me, Senator Chamberlain, am I reading this correctly, that would mean like Blue Cross Blue Shield and Medica would then be opened up to be able to be offering life insurance?
Mr. Franzen.
Mr. Chairman, members, I don't believe that that's the case. Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Branson, can you explain to me why, when it says this subdivision does not prohibit combining life coverage with one or more of the following coverages?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonoff, first of all, I don't believe the type of products are described here are the Blue Cross type of products. It's more like what you'd see for an Aflac. Theoretically, there might be some other limited benefit coverage that a health insurer could write if they had, if they were admitted to write life insurance, none of which are, by the way, and if the product had been approved by, the life product had been approved by the Department of Commerce, none of which are. So I think there is a theoretical construct, but it's very limited. Where this is really happening around the company is life insurance companies offering small, relatively small fixed indemnity products, the disease or the hospital, as an accommodation to their clients, because customers are looking for that product, and so it's not an in lieu of life insurance. It's just a rider. It permits a rider.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonhoff.
The reason why this, you know, to me, opens up other issues, really going both directions, is that we are one of the few states that have a closed nonprofit system for our health care, and so we, you know, we're such a highly regulated state with regard to health insurance, and now we're combining two different, we're talking about combining two different things, and I would just want more. I'm Dominic, looks like you aren't sure about that, and I wonder if you could offer your thoughts.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonhoff, I would note lines 119 and 120. Each product and each coverage and each provider has specific laws and regulatory standards, none of which are waived in each case. The life product and the life company have to comply with Minnesota law. The health product, the health company, have to comply with Minnesota law. There are some indemnity companies writing health insurance in Minnesota. This would have no impact, say, on Blue Cross's not-for-profit status. It would not open up anything. We have the experience of 48 other states to demonstrate that. And Mr. Chairman, I would yield to Mr. Spezzetto.
Mr. Spezzetto.
Mr. Chairman, I just to assist on the issue related to Blue Cross. Blue Cross is incorporated as a 62C nonprofit health service corporation. As a health service corporation, I don't think they have the ability to sell life products. That said, I don't think there's anything to prohibit Blue Cross from creating a life insurance company under Statute 62A and selling life insurance, but they have chosen not to do that. I don't think they would. I doubt whether the 62D health maintenance organizations would be interested in life insurance as well. So I don't think that's as much of an issue as it may seem.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I can bring some clarification, too. I think if the consumer wanted two different types of these products, they're all regulated, but if they could be sold together, it would be cheaper for the consumer. If there was two products that they wanted and they were in one policy or package, that'd be the only benefit I can see to the consumer. But in the end, they're going to have to want both products. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been worth it for them.
Okay. Senator Chamberlain, I will announce that we do have a quorum. And currently, right now, we're on, of the two authors' amendments, we've been discussing the A4. So why don't we take that up right now? So Senator Chamberlain offers the A4 amendment as an author's amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. And the motion prevails, and the A4 amendment is adopted. And then, Senator Chamberlain, let's go back to the A3 amendment, which you had previously went through. And members, this is also an author's amendment, so Senator Chamberlain moves the A3 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. And the amendment, the motion prevails, and the A3 amendment is adopted. Is there any discussion on the bill as amended? Does anybody else in the audience want to testify either in favor of or in opposition to the bill? Then seeing none, do members have any other questions?
Mr. Chair, if I can make a
Senator Gazelka?
I think this is a consumer bill. I think the fact that, thank you, Mr. Chair, that the industry wants to come alongside this and the agents want to is a positive thing, but it does create accountability. And I think that's what the consumer wants to know, that wherever they go, they know that they're going to have somebody that has to document what they're doing, has to really show, make the case that this is the right product for the consumer. and there's going to be recorded proof of that. And so I think in the end, it really is a consumer.
Well, Senator Gazelka, I'd like to think that all the bills we take up in this committee are consumer bills. Maybe some more than others.
Yes.
That might be your point. Okay, then. Then Senator Chamberlain renews his motion that Senate File 877 be recommended to pass and sent to general orders. The Judiciary Committee has not, or they do not need to see this. They've waived their original request. So to that motion, then, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. And the motion prevails, and Senate File 877 is recommended to pass and sent to the general orders. Thank you. And Senator Brown. This is going to be the first time. Got two of them. This one. So we'll do the contract, service contracts first. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Today I'm here to talk about Senate File 387 dealing with indemnification, and I do have an author's amendment, Mr. Chair.
Let's take that up first, and we'll make sure that gets out to members. Looks like this would be the A1 amendment.
Mr. Chairman, is this the Committee of Original Jurisdiction?
Yes, it is, Senator Rest.
So the reference here was changed on the floor?
saying yes, but I wanted to understand your question.
Judiciary.
Yeah, it was originally referred to judiciary, but...
Oh, yes, yes. It originally went to judiciary, then there was a motion to send it here on the floor. Okay, members, you should have the A1 amendment. So Senator Brown moves the A1 amendment as an author's amendment to his bill. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. And the motion prevails, and the A1 amendment is adopted. Senator Brown, to your bill.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. The purpose of this legislation is to address problems design professionals, such as engineers and architects, have with uninsurable clauses in contracts with clients. This legislation recognizes that the professional liability of design professionals is limited only to their acts and omissions, and that they cannot insure others for their liability. And, Mr. Chair, I do have two people here to testify in favor of this today.
Welcome to the committee. If you would like to identify yourselves and who you represent.
Mr. Chair, members, good morning. My name is Dan Murphy. I'm a board member of ACEC, the American Council of Engineering Companies.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I want to represent ACEC. We're a group representing 150 private engineering consulting companies in the state of Minnesota. We represent, in that group, 6,500 employees. And we operate in roads and bridges, in the built environment, environmental issues, providing consulting engineering services and ideas and innovative solutions. We've reviewed this amendment with our major clients, including the League of Cities and the state of Minnesota. Now, I'm also a consulting engineer. I'm a CEO and president of a firm, Meyer, Borglin & Johnson. We're the largest structural engineering firm in the state of Minnesota. And what we're seeing over the last few years is a tendency towards over-languaging our contracts having us provide an insurance that we can't provide through our professional liability insurance. And so we cannot provide additional insured certificates representing our professional negligence. We do provide, all of our firms provide professional insurance for professional, professional negligence insurance, but we cannot provide the insurance for other liabilities that would be additional insured category. So we wanted to make that case, and that's what we're seeing, this trend towards maybe a little bit over-languaging the contracts. I see language that suggests that I need to provide defense costs for even alleged negligence. And so we're interested in seeing that distinction made because we think this is a unique situation that professional design professionals find themselves in.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Eric Heiberg. I'm an attorney at the firm of Coleman Hull and Van Vliet, and I'm also here on behalf of ACEC. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about what Section 337 does right now. Right now, the statute prohibits certain types of indemnification agreements that require construction companies, and including design professionals, from having to indemnify for problems that are caused by other than their own fault or negligence. However, the current bill has an exception in there where it allows a bad or an illegal indemnification clause to survive as long as the party granting the indemnification has promised to buy insurance to back up that obligation. So in other words, you can have an otherwise illegal indemnification clause saved by the promise to buy insurance, which is fine for contractors and other parties who can buy that insurance. The problem we're having with design professionals is that that insurance simply isn't available on the market. And the reason for that is fairly simple. Design professionals have two basic kinds of insurance they buy. One is called general liability, and that covers things such as slipping on a banana peel and just general negligence and accidents. However, general liability insurance specifically excludes professional services. And as a result, there's no coverage under general liability for most of what a design professional does. They have to buy what's called professional liability or E&O insurance for that risk. And when they buy that professional liability insurance, that professional liability insurance covers just them. They can't add people as additional insureds to that policy, and they also can't buy what's called blanket contractual liability insurance like you can on a general liability policy. So the result is that when you buy a professional liability policy, you are not able to buy the insurance that these overbroad indemnification provisions seek to have. So what's happened in the marketplace is there was a case in 1992 called Holmes versus Watson Forsberg, and that gave owners a direction on how to write these real broad indemnification clauses and still have them be enforceable by adding language saying that there will be insurance purchased to back up this indemnity. And so owners have gotten good at writing those. Unfortunately, the insurance they seek is simply unavailable for design professionals in the market. And so the bill that we're proposing is to reflect that reality and say, even where you promise to buy that insurance, if it's a promise to buy professional liability insurance, the overbroad indemnification is still unenforceable.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Brown, do you have other testifiers?
I do have one other, if he's here.
Mr. John Stricotta?
Stricotta.
Okay.
Welcome. I'll be brief. My name is John Stricotta. I represent AI Minnesota, which is a group of architects in the state, and we share the similar concerns that ACEC, our partners in design and construction, do. For us, this is just a simple act of fairness in contracting. It's not right for us to be holding owners harmless from things that we have no control or responsibility over. So we ask for your consideration of this correction to that so that we can move on and get insurance for the kinds of things that are appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from members? No? Is there anybody else in the audience that would like to speak in favor of the bill? And how about if we move to, I have somebody on the list of Mr. Kurt Smith to speak in opposition. So welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Curtis Smith. I am an attorney with Moss & Barnett in Minneapolis. I am the chapter attorney for the American Subcontractors Association of Minnesota. We're here to speak in opposition to one small piece of the bill. Just to give you a little background who ASA Minnesota is, we are the Minnesota chapter of the American Subcontractors Association, which is a national organization representing well in excess of 3,000 subcontractors across the United States. ASA is dedicated to helping and advocating for subcontractors as a whole, across all trade lines, across all union affiliation. It's simply to help benefit subcontractors and their business. ASA Minnesota has in excess of 100 subcontractor members, again, across all trade lines, across all union affiliation, and in both residential and commercial businesses. In fact, studies have shown that when you talk about buildings and things that are constructed, that 90-plus percent of the work is actually done by subcontractors or their employees. We oppose a very narrow portion of this bill. We agree that the insurance issues that have been raised here are serious, and we agree with the statements that have been made in favor of the bill as to everybody should be responsible for their own fault, negligence, or responsibility. However, what we do object to and disagree with is simply the attempt in this bill to carve out one member, the design professionals of the construction team, of the construction process. And the construction process includes not only design professionals, but also general contractors and importantly to us, subcontractors. And we all have the same problem that the design professionals have identified here, that is these overbroad, overbearing, and illegal under 337.02 indemnity clauses, whereby we are repeatedly and constantly required to indemnify general contractors, owners, and even architects and engineers for their own negligence, which is a violation of the statute. Yet under 337.05, what I call the insurance loophole, we are also required to buy insurance. And what effectively happens is the subcontractors become the insurer for the entire project because they have to name additional insureds and indemnify the general contractor for the general contractor's own negligence, the owner's own negligence. It all falls down on us. We believe very strongly that if there's going to be an exception made to this insurance loophole, that it should be for everybody in the industry, subcontractors included. To be very specific as to how we suggest that that might be addressed in the author's amendment, in line, what is line 1.7 of the author's amendment, where what was added is except that a promise to provide professional liability insurance. If the word professional were taken out and it were allowed to read except that a promise to provide liability insurance for the benefit of others shall not be enforceable, we would wholeheartedly support this bill and including the author's amendment. Ready to answer any questions that anybody has. I want to take up too much time here.
Question, Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm very interested in that argument. I'm a co-author on the bill with Senator Brown, but I'm more interested in Senator Brown's reaction and if that's something you would consider or if you think, or just what you do think about expanding your bill at this point or if you prefer not to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Rest.
Senator Brown.
Yes. Thank you for your question. I want to find resolution for all groups involved. However, this bill was introduced on the 21st of February, and it wasn't until yesterday afternoon that any group came to me with concerns about this bill. So at this point in time, I'm not willing to change the amendment. I would be possibly between now and when it moves on to the next committee, but I need some time to have these discussions, and I haven't been given that time.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Rest.
If this bill is successful in this committee, it would go to judiciary?
Yes, Senator Rest, it would be referred to judiciary.
Well, Senator Brown, and I'm sorry, I don't remember your name.
Smith.
I should remember Smith. Mr. Curtis name. Smith. Yeah. I
and
think.
Spell it. Don't feel bad.
I think Senator Brown's reaction is extremely reasonable, and but I do hope, and I wouldn't vote to change it here either. But I hope you will be open to, you know, to talking to these people, and if in judiciary it seems that it's a reasonable request, I hope you'll be open to that. But I would agree with you. If you only heard about it yesterday, I think that is that's reasonable to say no at this time. And sometimes, however, we also know that people only get interested in a bill when they see it's actually scheduled for a hearing, and otherwise they feel like they don't have to bother. And so that does happen to us on occasion, but I would support Senator Brown's position at this point as a co-author.
Thank you. Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I definitely can see more conversation, because if you take out professional, which is E&O, and then it's just all liability, that's general liability, it's a much, much broader issue. I'm glad you guys are talking about it rather than me. And I just wanted to make a comment, Mr. Smith. You talked about contractors having to carry the load for the rest, but I think the general contractor also has to carry his own insurance, so it's not like he's not carrying insurance as well.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, that is correct, but the effect of what happens with these indemnity clauses and then the insurance provisions that Mr. Heiberg talked about in his testimony is to make the subcontractors the primary insurer of everybody on the contract. And so the subcontractor's insurance becomes primary, that is first. If there's an injury, a workman or worker injured on the site, the general contractor can then ask a subcontractor under these clauses, regardless of whether that subcontractor was involved in the incident, to defend and indemnify any loss, even if the subcontractor is not found 1% negligent at all. And the subcontractor's insurance then has to hire the attorney, which I'm all in favor of, and also pay the cost of indemnity. And what that does is it makes the subcontractors the primary insurer of the project. Their insurance costs go up dramatically. In effect, the general contractors go down, because now what they have is effectively secondary or excess insurance. So this is the problem that our members are having with this whole setup the way it is today.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, with your indulgence, I'd like to respond.
Mr. Heiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I think that Senator Gazelka hit it right on the head. If we do take the word professional out of this, it changes the bill. We've worked very hard at ACEC to build a coalition of owners, the general contractors, and the design professionals on this bill. And if not a fully supportive coalition, at least non-opposition. And changing the bill by taking the word professional out will dramatically alter that. We will lose the general contractors. We will also lose many of the owners groups that we work with. So I would encourage you not to make that change at this point. In addition, there's a significant difference between design professionals and subcontractors, and that is that subcontractors, even though it is a hardship and they can and expensive, they can still buy this insurance. It's available on the market. It's not available for design professionals, and that's why we put it forward in this bill.
Okay. All right, then.
If I might address that last comment, I'm sorry to be rude, but
Mr. Smith,
the 337.05 already addresses the issue if the insurance is not available. It specifically provides that if 337.05 subdivision 3, existing law already says that if the insurance that you're being asked to provide is not reasonably commercially available, then the obligation is null and void. So while I understand what they're trying to say, existing law addresses the concern they're raising about it not being available.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Senator Rest.
One further thing. Does the department have a position on this bill?
Mr. Reich, if you could maybe speak into the microphone. Head shaking will show up on the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Rest, John Reich, Department of Commerce. Trying not to get up on every bill today. At this point, we are just monitoring the bill. We don't currently have a position.
Good enough.
Thank you. Okay. Any further discussion? We have a gentleman that would like to address the committee. Please identify yourself for the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Rest, my name is Justin Kaufman. I am an attorney with the Department of Administration. And I believe maybe your question was appropriately set forth to us. In the past, we have opposed this legislation, and we have no intention of doing so this year. We've managed to work out an agreement for our contracts with the folks from ACEC, and we certainly appreciate that. But in order to better answer your question, I do want to refer you to State Statute 645.27, and that indicates that the state is not bound by the passage of a law unless named therein. We don't see the state of Minnesota as named herein, and so the position we are holding is that these changes would not apply to contracts entered into by the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for that clarification, and I appreciate the work that you all have done with ACEC on this.
Thank you, Senator Rest.
Thank you, and I'll just say that I also appreciate that, because I know that, Senator Rest, you've authored this bill in the past. Mm-hmm. That seemed to be the sticking point at that time was with the Department of Administration, and so I'm very pleased that that has been worked out.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, then, is there anybody else in the audience that wanted to speak for or against this bill? And we don't have any other amendments before us. So then, with that, Senator Brown moves that Senate File 387, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Judiciary and Public Safety. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say nay. And the motion prevails. And Senate File 387, as amended, is recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Judiciary and Public Safety. That always seems so redundant.
No problem.
Senator Brown, your next bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Next bill is Senate File 955, and I do have an author's amendment, the A1 amendment for this bill.
Okay, we'll hand that out. Okay, members, Senator Brown moves the A1 author's amendment to Senate File 955. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, say nay. And the A1 amendment is adopted. Senator Brown, to your bill.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill we have before us today is regarding the regulation of pawn stores. It streamlines and simplifies the way pawn stores currently do business. It does three things. First, it standardizes the period of time that pawn stores are required to hold merchandise. For pawn transactions, that time is 60 days. For purchased items, it is 30 days. Second, it states that these changes supersede local ordinances in order to preserve a standard application statewide. Again, the attempt here is to standardize the operations of the business to make it more efficient. And third, it decreases the distance restrictions for a pawn store that can locate near a casino down from 10 miles to 1,500 feet. And, Mr. Chair, I do have Mr. Cassidy here to testify on the bill.
Mr. Cassidy, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Paul Cassidy with Leonard Street and Diner here on behalf of the Rixman Companies, which includes Pawn America, Payday America, MyBridge, and Exchange Street. The Senate file before you is legislation regarding the regulation of pawn stores. This legislation would standardize statewide the period of time that pawn stores are required to hold merchandise. And that merchandise is either taken in by a pawn store through a pawn transaction or through a direct purchase transaction. For pawn transactions, we standardize the time at 60 days, and for purchased items, through the amendment you have before you, we standardize it for 30 days. Holding merchandise for pawn stores is a very expensive proposition. The hold periods have not been revisited for years, and they range anywhere from 21 days in some local jurisdictions up to 120 days. The automated pawn system, which some of you are familiar with, which is a system that law enforcement uses to have pawn shops report daily the transactions that they take in, which includes all the information on your driver's license, has been around for now 15 years, and it allows law enforcement to have immediate access to information regarding pawns, negating the need for very long pawn periods. Long pawn periods are also very expensive for not only the pawn shop, but for the consumer. Most of these costs for storing and holding pawn transactions and purchase transactions are essentially passed along to the consumer. This legislation also changes the, I'm sorry, exclusively supersedes local ordinances, as it only pertains to those hold periods. No other portion of the pawn statute is being impacted as it relates to a local jurisdiction's ability to regulate pawn stores. They still hold most of the cars, whether it's local zoning ordinances or anything else they've passed into their local ordinances as it relates to the regulation of pawn shops. And finally, the legislation takes the distance restriction for which a pawn store can locate near a casino down from 10 miles to 1,500 feet. Our understanding from legislative history is that the 10-mile restriction was put in law in 1996 and hasn't been revisited since then. I think in 1996, if we look back, we were in the throes of gaming expansion in the state of Minnesota. This was put into law. We don't know where the 10-mile barrier came from or for what reason. The only other place we could find in Minnesota statutes that addresses a barrier like this is with money exchangers and their proximity to a casino, and that's 1,500 feet in state statute. The last issue I'd like to point out in regard to the barrier is that we compete with a lot of other businesses that are unregulated, including jewelry stores, secondhand goods stores like Play It Against Sports. I don't mean to pick on them, but it's probably the best example. They are not under any restrictions in terms of the distance in which they can locate near a casino, and a lot of our customers look to those retail outlets as well for transactions. So we are trying to have equal footing with our competition. As you well know, gold and silver is at all-time highs. It's a very big business. We can't participate in those transactions unless we're located 10 miles from the front door of a casino. A jeweler such as the Gold Guys or even a traditional jeweler like the Shane Company or Wixom Jewelers can locate a store next door to a casino if they'd like, under no restrictions that we're under. Mr. Chairman, I stand for questions.
Senator Rest.
Yeah, thank you. I don't know much about the policy of Section 1, but I'm very interested in the policy of Section 2. And 1,500 feet doesn't seem to me to be very far. I would assume that the reason why there was any restriction put in at all was to not have this, beaten path between generally people who are addicted to gambling to make it too easy for them to sell things and then go and gamble away. We have other kinds of restrictions about how you can obtain money to gamble and ATM machines and so on, or at least the casinos do. But 1,500 feet is like from here to the Veterans Building. It's not very far. Even I can walk that very easily. And I'm just a little bit uncomfortable with that part of the policy. And then a further question of that is, why wouldn't we want to just make, or is it the case that a local ordinance can determine where a pawn shop is located? And if that's the case, I would, leave it up to the local governments to say whether something is too far or too close. And I would be more in favor of just striking this part of the statute. That seems to me to make more sense if you are willing to have, the local government has a jurisdiction over the location of these instances. And Senator Brown, I wonder what you think of just repealing that part, if indeed there is local ordinances that would prevail, and if they want it to be 3,000 feet, or if they want it to, or if they want it to be next door, if they think that that's good public policy for their citizens, I'd be willing to trust their judgment in that. That's my own initial reaction just having seen this?
Senator Rest, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because just seconds before you brought that up, we were just having a little side conversation on that, and I thought that 1,500 feet. I mean, the libertarian in me says, why do we have any restriction at all?
Mm-hmm.
I think, and again, Senator Brown can react to this, I think we're kidding ourselves. If it's just like when we did the liquor issue with the college campus.
Mm-hmm.
Are we kidding ourselves if we think that that is some sort of a solution to college students and such? And likewise here, if someone is under captivated by a gambling addiction,
mm-hmm.
Whether it's 1,500 feet or 10 miles or any distance, I don't think is going to deter that.
But Mr. Chairman, don't you think that local jurisdictions reflecting local community values of whatever sort,
and that makes a
I
lot
mean,
of
they
sense
can decide
Center-West.
That you can't have a liquor store 10 feet away from a school, and we've seen some big controversies over that more recently, and I don't know if it was a school or something, but in the city of Minneapolis, about just how far or whether you where you measure it from, and we saw that with the bill the other day. I think we should move to repeal 325J10. Senator Brown.
Yeah, Senator Brown,
yes,
why don't you react to that from
yes,
our discussion?
Mr. Chair, and Senator Rest, I think that's an excellent suggestion, and I would be in favor of that.
Senator Rest, we want to make sure that.
Could I be reassured that there is some local control over the types of businesses and where they're located or how many of them, so that we're just not letting 10 pawn shops all of a sudden open up and without any play in the game by the local governments?
Senator Rest, we have ordinance consistency. It looks like Section 3 of the bill. Let me just take a look at that. And it, okay, with the exception of Section 325J.08, which is the
710 for the right.
I'm sorry, we'll follow this through, make sure I understand this. But having Section 3 of the bill in here, it does say nothing in this chapter preempts or supersedes any ordinance adopted by a municipality that provides for more restrictive regulation of pawn brokers and pawn transactions.
So that should take care of it. Mr. Chairman, with Senator Brown's support, I would move to repeal State Statutes 325J.10.
So I understand the Senator Rest. It's not just striking Section 2 out of the bill, but
no, it's
striking
just
the
that
statute.
How do I do that?
Yeah, Mr. Stang.
I think the amendment would be deleting Section 2 from the bill, adding an additional section to the bill, which is a repealer section.
Yes.
And it would say Section 325J.10 is repealed.
Okay.
Senator Brown, is that okay?
That sounds good.
Okay, that would be my motion.
Okay, so members have heard the Rest motion. Are there any members with any discussion on that? Okay, does anybody in the audience have any discussion on the particular Rest motion then? Okay, so members, you've heard the amendment. All those in favor of the Rest amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, say nay. And the amendment prevails. And the Rest amendment is adopted. Okay. Let's see then. So that's taken care of. Senator Brown, did you have any other testifiers?
I do not. None that I'm aware of, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Is there anybody else in the audience that wants to testify in favor of or against the bill? We have somebody. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Ann Finn. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. And I want to, first of all, express our appreciation for Mr. Cassidy and the advocates for this bill for addressing a number of the concerns that have been brought forward by cities as well as law enforcement. But as those of you who have served on a city council very likely know, pawn shops have been welcomed in some communities more than in others. And changes to laws that regulate pawn brokers or pawn goods tend to cause some anxiety for local units of government and the officials who serve in those positions. Thankfully, some in the pawn industry have taken great measures to comply with state and local laws, particularly when it comes to minimizing transactions involving stolen property. But the fact is that others in the industry have been less cooperative. And what I want to offer to you today is that we are concerned about some of the preemption language in the bill, particularly the cap of 60 days on hold periods. And we, if we could, would like to preserve our authority in this area so that the cities that are currently imposing a longer hold period could continue to do that. I was going to make some remarks about the distance between pawn shops and casinos, but I think Senator Rest really got at the heart of our comments on that. The local control over that is preferable, I think, at least my first reaction to that. That said, cities don't have a lot of experience with casinos, and so we'll have to see what happens there. But I would just respectfully ask that you proceed carefully with this bill, because we may have some backlash out there when we make changes to this, and some city officials may have to change their local ordinances in order to comply.
Thank you, Ms. Finn. I wanted to follow up on that a little bit to make sure that we understand hold periods and zero in on that a little bit since the issue was brought up. Mr. Cassidy, tell us a little bit about how hold periods work. I understand there's different hold periods. Now, this is, again, this is where someone brings something in, they sell it essentially to the pawn store, then there's that redemption period. I'm getting the head nod. Okay. And then when that redemption period expires, is that when the hold period comes after that? Or I want to make sure we understand exactly what the hold period is. I'm a little unclear about that.
Mr. Chairman, members, first of all, the hold period is meant, obviously, to hold merchandise for the benefit of law enforcement so that the merchandise is there for 30 days under this proposal for a purchased item. So if any of you watch Pawn Stars, that's the transactions they typically do, which is someone comes in with a stereo, and we offer them a price for it and give them cash for that item. That item is ours then, but we still have to hold that item for anywhere from 21 to 120 days in local jurisdictions around the state. A pawned item.
I'm sorry, if I could, sorry, one second, Mr. Cassidy. So the time period is not necessarily dictated by what the item is. It's dictated by an ordinance.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And to Senator Rest's question about local ordinances, obviously, and I think I said in my opening remarks, that the local units of government hold all the cards. They create the ordinance based on state statute for for regulation of pawn shops. I would venture to guess for every dollar our clients spend to locate a Jimmy John's on Grand Avenue, they would spend $10 locating a pawn shop. That's how difficult it is working with local government and the anxiety that it brings, I think, to Mrs. Finn's comments about locating and opening pawn shops in cities and municipalities. Getting to the second part of your question on the pawn transaction, it's basically the same thing. You come in, you would like to leave something with us in exchange for cash, loan. We take that item in. We have to hold that item for, again, anywhere from 21 to 120 days. And when the redemption period, or you can come in, you know, whenever you feel there, whenever you have the cash to pay off the pawn, come in, pay that off, and you get your merchandise back. Otherwise, if the redemption period ends and you haven't done that and it's expired, then we hold the merchandise and sell it at our retail locations.
Okay. So Mr. Cassidy, you're looking for some consistency.
Correct.
Across that, and then that therein lies the rub with consistency versus the local control issue on this. Okay.
Correct. Mr. Chairman, and what I would say, Ms. Finn and I have been discussing this as well. All the jurisdictions that we operate in participate and subscribe to the automated pawn system. And that system is based in the city of Minneapolis with the Minneapolis Police Department. They run it. It's statewide. Each jurisdiction that wants to, they subscribe to that, and they pay a fee through fees that we pay. Ms. Finn's concerned about a lot of jurisdictions that might not participate in that system, and that wouldn't impact us because all the jurisdictions that we're in, the APS exists, and we do overnight reporting. We would be more than happy to discuss somehow addressing those jurisdictions that don't have that immediate overnight reporting where law enforcement and local officials would be more concerned about that.
What's that? Is there any further discussion then? Okay, then.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Sparks.
Does this bill have another stop?
It doesn't. I don't believe anybody's requested it from our committee, so it would be sent to the general orders.
Okay,
then seeing no further discussion, Senator Brown, he moves that Senate File 955 be recommended to pass, as amended, I should say, and be recommended to pass and sent to the general orders. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed say nay.
No.
Nay.
And the motion prevails, and the Senate File 955 is recommended to pass and sent to the general orders.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Chamberlain.
Technical bill, huh? We're done, I'll tell you.
Okay.
Senator Chamberlain gets a second bite at the apple today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I'd like to move Senate File 1045.
Senator Chamberlain, do you have any amendments at all?
We have three, but if it's all right with you, here's how we'd like to proceed. There's one controversial. They're all three authors' amendment. One controversial. So what we'd like to do, we thought it might be easier if you'd like to do it this way, is to take that one out first, let them do the explanation of the bill, and then after that, then we can put those two other author's amendments in. Would that be okay?
You can, or if you want.
Do it the other way around.
Yeah. If they're all author's amendments, let's just do them all. I originally thought that they were going to be coming from some other members, and we'd hold off on that, but if they're all three author's amendments, let's just do it, and then we'll just address the bill, I think, right up front.
Okay.
So if we could pass out those amendments. I mean, we'll do them one at a time.
Or, Mr. Chairman, you could just put the two non-controversial amendments on there if he wants to discuss the third one separately.
Well, I think what we'll do, members, is I'd like to be consistent with the author's amendment. Let's just put the bill in the shape that you'd like it, and then we'll certainly discuss the bill. And if the amendment offered is not to the committee's liking, we could always certainly move to strike that.
Thank you.
That section, but let's put it in the shape the author would like to present it in.
So first we have
looking at the A1 amendment.
Start with the
first.
A1 amendment.
And so members, all in favor of adopting the A1 amendments, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. And motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted.
Next. Chair, is the A2 amendment.
Senator Chamberlain moves the A2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Chairman,
oh,
I think
yes.
Just getting past just
oh, I'm sorry. Okay. We'll hold on until people get back. All members have the A2 amendment. Senator Chamberlain moves the A2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Mm-hmm.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. And the motion prevails. The A2 amendment is adopted.
And Mr. Chair, one final amendment, author's amendment, A3.
Let's make sure all the members have the A3 amendment. And it looks like the A3 amendment is just a simple delete section 6. Is that that's how I'm reading it?
Oh.
Okay, members. Senator Chamberlain moves the A3 amendment. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails. The A3 amendment is adopted. Okay, Senator Chamberlain, if you wanted to explain your bill all the amendments that have been adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll refer to Mr. Commodore on my right. He'll walk us through the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Again, my name is Robert Commodore with the Department of Commerce. As has been our practice in the last few years, the bills that we're bringing before you are technical cleanups. We don't believe that there's anything controversial in the bill. They're pretty simple. Sections 2, 3, 4, and 5, and 6, or 2, 3, 4, and 5, are simple cleanups of definitions. As you may recall, we passed a number of bills in the last few years, updating education requirements and how the delivery of those education courses is being made. And we've had a number of questions over time from the providers, and these technical cleanups just clarify the definitions. Also, the delivery mechanism of some of these courses has changed with the advent of the internet and web chats and things like that. So these changes in the definitions just address those things. Call your attention to sections 12 and 13.
Mr. Chairman, can we ask questions?
Certainly, Senator Ress, if we could, yes, I think that'll be beneficial since there's a lot of sections here. If members, if you have questions during the presentation. So, yeah, Senator Ress.
Mr. Chairman, often you ask, you know, what problem does this solve? Or is there an issue that this is supposed to address? And I was wondering if those first sections about continuing professional education courses. As I recall, there was some scandal, I guess, about some unscrupulous persons who were saying that they were doing continuing professional education, and it was a matter of somebody going in and plopping down their dollars and getting a certificate. And I'm wondering if these provisions here are addressing not only the enforcement of current law, because of course they shouldn't have been doing it, but are you hoping that this will make it clear to people who are providing continuing professional education in the licensing areas that you oversee that they will? They will understand perfectly what they have to do, and there's no vagueness in the law anymore.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ress, that is an excellent point. That is exactly what we are trying to do here, okay. Based upon that scandal and some of the other things that came around that time.
I don't even remember what field it was in, but I do remember it.
People had classes at the golf course. The classes lasted, they were supposed to be 8 hours. They lasted about 15 minutes, and everybody made their tee times. And so these changes here clarify those definitions of what an hour means for class time. It talks about the guaranteed seat time and how we make sure that those things are happening.
Thank you. I think that's an improvement.
Senator Vanderveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question on Section 5, where you can't take more than 8 hours in one day. Why would that? That seems, well, maybe you could offer some explanation for that.
Mr. Commodore.
That is primarily trying to be consistent with across all the states, that's kind of a uniform standard based upon education providers, research that was done as to how much time a person could be reasonably expected to really maintain attention and comprehension of a subject matter. The question gets begged. You're correct that with the advent of online courses, it didn't make sense necessarily that we only allow 8 hours. But again, based upon the standards with the other states at the NEIC, and based upon suggestions by several institutions and studies, we felt that the 8 hours was appropriate for one day. It keeps it consistent with what could be done in a classroom, and so to make the classroom and the online things consistent, we wanted to stay with the 8 hours.
Okay. Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the Speaker, I really have the same question, but I'm thinking about scenarios where it would be nice to have like 10 hours. If you're taking continuing ed and let's say it's 2 hours at a time through different events, and suddenly you now need a little more than eight, but you don't want to have to come back a second day. You don't want to stay overnight in some situations. You don't want to pay for a second day of classes if there was a place where you had the opportunity to get just a little bit more. And I guess I'm wondering if you would be opposed to changing that to 10 hours.
Well, Mr. Chair, I wasn't quite finished when I was.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. Question,
sure.
Senator, does this, can we come back to you, or is this to this point?
It's to this point.
It is. Okay, Senator Gazelka, you want to yield to Senator Vanderbilt?
Yes. I'm sorry. I
might be a little harsher than 10 hours on my proposal.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, you go ahead.
What? Well, I'll finish my, Mr. Chair, finish the question, and we may go farther than this, but would you be open to changing that to 10 hours?
Mr. Commodore.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Gazelka, I think we, as a state, want to try and make as much of this uniform across all the states as possible. We have both in real estate and insurance some efforts to maintain uniformity for those people that are licensed in more than one state. It would be our preference to keep to the 8 hours, but we'd certainly bend to your will.
I'll wait, Mr. Chair, for Senator Vanderveer's comments.
Senator Vanderveer.
Thank you. Perhaps, though, you know, some of us have like more than one job and stuff. we don't just work 8 hours a day. I mean, it's in a perfect world, which some, I don't know who lives in that world. No one I know, actually. But sometimes we might need to get, you know, 12 hours. I think it's our business. I think the legislature, I know, meets more than 8 hours sometimes, and we seem to do all right.
But we don't get any credit for it.
Well, that could be debatable, Senator Ress, as to whether what happens in those hours. But I think it's up to, like, grown-ups to make those decisions for themselves, as long as they're taking the courses and if there's tests and things and they pass them. That's just my opinion.
Okay. We have Senator Bonoff. And if it's to this point, otherwise, I mean, I want to keep on saying.
Yeah.
To the point, Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I echo the comments made so far. And I spend a lot of my time working in the education arena at the Capitol, and we are moving towards outcomes versus what we call inputs. And so putting any kind of a time limit, I think, is not in keeping with what the trends are showing, which is as long as people accomplish what they need to accomplish, that ought to be kind of the lens that we look through. And so I am not certain that we ought to be worried about being consistent with the other states in this arena. And then I did have a question on an earlier page, but if you'd like me to wait. And
we'll come back to that, Senator Bonoff.
Okay.
Okay, Senator Rest, to
this
point.
Thank you. Oh, well, I completely disagree with Senator Bonoff. The continuing professional education requirements are stated in the number of hours. This is not like K-12 education where we're looking at where we've gotten away from seat time.
And the we can say you can get no more than 8 hours a day or 10 hours a day, but the professional organizations say, and I can't read, I'm retired as a CPA now, but it used to be 40 hours. You had to have 40 hours a year, 120 hours over the three-year licensure period, and you had to pass the courses or you had to be in attendance, and it was more that you were seat time was the deal. And if we can't go back and talk about outcomes, quite frankly, here, because the professional organizations have their input on how they have gone about this. So, I mean, unless we want to go back in here and say the CPAs have to base their things on outcomes rather than quote seat time, then I think we're really into something that is way beyond a technical provision in this bill. And often in those courses, it is a matter you don't get a test. You go and you are adults and you're simply instructed. So the outcome is that you were there for 8 hours, and that is what has been abused. And so I don't think that the comparison between a school day and what our children are going through and learning in the classroom, in that kind of classroom, is comparable at all to the requirements for continuing professional education. And maybe what's in this Section 5 is too prescriptive, but I mean, it does happen that you get 10 minutes of a break, and you know what that means? That means you sit there for 6 hours straight, and then you get to go. And that is what is trying to be avoided here. And we wouldn't have this if we had this proposal, it seems to me, if it hadn't been continuously and scandalously abused. So I would... Maybe they need to think about that a little bit more, or maybe 10 hours is okay. But we also know that there is a respect for uniform regulations from state to state, and I wouldn't want Minnesota to be known as, well, in Minnesota you can get away with anything. Anywhere else you can't, but here, hey, it doesn't matter. And the outcome is not just showing up. The outcome is showing up and sitting there painfully on occasion through the instruction on updating, you know, Minnesota tax law.
Well, Senator Rest, I've been biting my tongue through, so I have some strong opinions about continuing it and its value to begin with.
Well, there's that. I understand that.
It's a broader discussion. I know it's not for the department to determine that. It's for us to determine that. But I could go on. I held a real estate license for about 6 years. I don't currently. And I could go on about that. And honestly, I'll tell you that there's a couple of requirements, such as the ethics training and the law of agency that applied. But filling out the remaining 15 hours every year on things that the industry should be training you on. There is no public governmental interest in requiring a course on staging a home for a realtor when that is their own personal professional development. There is
Were
no
you any good at
that? And it goes on and on and on.
We would never approve a class like that either.
But it's honestly, we wouldn't have this before us if we didn't have all these continuing ed requirements, which honestly are industry driven. And they are there just like a lot of licensure to fence people out of an occupation and make it more difficult and all of that, a lot of it. I think it should not just be minimized to what's the strict government interest and leave the rest of it up for the private sector to do their own training. But then you got me going. So, Senator Daines.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that we could spend hours and hours talking about continuing education and how we'd like to see it change, so we may not want to go there today. But I, too, would encourage the Commerce Committee to take a look at the hours per day. I think that that could be changed to a higher limit. If we're going to put a limit on it at all, I'd certainly like to see it changed to at least 10 hours because, as Senator Gazilka alluded to earlier, there are times when you travel 50 to 100 miles to go to a continuing education, and it would be nice to be able to pick up those extra hours and not have to either stay overnight or something like that. So I, too, would encourage that.
If I could ask Mr. Commodore, in Senator Dame's case, rural, he lives in a rural area in his insurance agency, and you probably have to come into the Twin Cities for a lot of these, I
Well,
imagine.
Twin Cities, Mankato, you know, some various
center.
Areas.
What, Mr. Commodore, was that issue of travel and over time, was that taken into consideration at all in this proposal?
Mr. Chairman, yes, it was. We did look at that. Again, I sit on the producer licensing working group with the NAIC, and that was a big discussion. In fact, we had a special hearing two meetings ago about the value of education and the delivery of education. So, yes, all those things were considered in this effort. Just leave it at that. We did think about those things.
Okay. Thank you. We have three other. We have Brown, Bonhoff, Vanderveer, and then Rest again. Senator Brown.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to agree with what Senator Bonhoff said, and that this should be outcome based. In as much as what it's addressing here, I don't believe it's addressing CPAs in this language. But I am a licensed insurance agent. I do specialize in Medicare plans, but not only do I take continuing ed every year, I take tests and education from each insurance company with whom I'm appointed. I take the national AHIP test every year, and CMS with Medicare is extremely stringent in making sure that we know what it is that we're selling. So I agree with Senator Bonhoff in saying that I don't see why we need a time restriction here. It should be outcome-based. What do we know? Do we know the facts on the products in which we're selling?
Senator Bonhoff.
Mr. Chair and Senator Brown did say what I was going to say, that really I was just going to go back to Senator Rest and say that it should be a body of knowledge that we're accountable for, and that can be measured by tests, credits, whatever. But in terms of this technical bill, given this is new language, I'm just wondering if perhaps given all this conflict around that it shouldn't be right here at this time as just a technical change. I don't know what it was before, I guess. And then I just had a question on another piece, if I might.
Go ahead. Yes,
thank you. I'm wondering why we need to define classroom course as being based on no geographical separation, different from distance learning, different from self-study. Is that important in law that we have that definition? Because, again, I think that as things are changing so quickly, we're going to outdate ourselves. Do we really need in statute to have those definitions? What is that value?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonhoff, that's a very good question as well. Again, the things that we have placed here, we felt, based upon on how we've been doing our business over the years, the complications that have come from some of the bad apples out there, that it was best for us to clearly define these things so we could set the standards and everybody understood what those standards were very clearly. We have already been operating under most of these things. We have not approved courses or approved education that exceeded these boundaries. So we just thought it was time to put this in the statute so that everyone would understand up front what the expectations were. We certainly didn't believe that any of this was going to be controversial, and we didn't want to raise those issues. We would certainly be willing, if that's the will of the committee, to change to 10 hours on that section, if that will move this forward.
Okay, Senator Chamberlain wanted to.
I was going to go to that point, Mr. Chair.
Sorry?
I was going to go to his point about the 10 hours.
Okay.
I mean, I guess I'm not clear why that 10 becomes the magic as opposed to our 8 or 12 or whatever, but, you know, everybody seems to be agreed upon on 10, and we would certainly go to that.
Yeah.
Okay, Senator Vandeveer.
Mr. Chair, I don't think there's agreement on a number there. Subdivision 1 is my biggest problem. I understand defining the breaks a little bit, having been to these classes, although. But I think this whole thing needs some work from this discussion, and I would move to delete Section 5.
Senator Vandeveer, you want to delete all of Section 5 or just Subdivision 1 of Section 5?
Well, it would leave that to the committee. I guess we could amend it to Subdivision. My primary concern is Subdivision 1 because I think if you go to a convention or something and you have a chance to get 12 hours, you should be able to do that. And I don't think there's anything wrong with it, and I don't think there's anything sneaky or underhanded. And I don't think Minnesota is a state where everything's allowed. I think some talk show hosts like Joel Suchere think it's a state where nothing's allowed. And I think that this moves in that direction. So,
okay, so Senator Vandeveer, I want to just be clear. I think what you're getting at then is just deleting Subdivision 1 or lines 2.13 through 2.17 of the bill is really what the discussion's been surrounding. Is that your amendment, Senator Vandeveer?
I think, Mr. Chair, I'm encouraged to delete Section 5. We'll start with that.
Okay, so to that motion then, to the Vandeveer motion is to delete Section 5. Senator Rest.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would oppose that. I think if you delete Section 5, then there's no need for Sections 1 through 4 because they are definitions that are then discussed in the other sections. You could delete Subdivision 1 without doing harm to the definitions. But I'm curious about the, if we didn't have this in here, could you still disapprove of a course that was longer than 8 hours and make every single requirement, although you're doing it for clarification, but could you, and for those that are applying to have courses approved, you don't have to approve a course that's longer than 8 hours or that have, depending on what kind of combinations. I mean, people bring a course to you to be approved because we have to have somebody approving what courses are going to be eligible to have a continuation of a license. So couldn't you just, and I'm not suggesting that you ought to because I think it's good to have it in the statute, but for those that want to get rid of this, it's not going to change your practice. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, to be technically correct, courses can be approved now for any length of hours as long as it meets the material meets that time frame.
But it's up to the department to do that. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, this provision just says that you can't have more than 8 hours, and you can't earn more than 8 hours of credit in a day, which is different than the approval of the courses.
Okay. So, Mr. Chairman, on that, I think if we're going to deal with that, then the more appropriate amendment would be to delete Subdivision 1, but given that the department has this authority, unless we want to put something in saying the department has no business talking about any professional education because we really don't care we don't care what your license means.
Okay. So, Senator Rest, are you making an amendment to the amendment then?
Yes, I would make an amendment to amendment that that would delete for the time being here only Subdivision 1.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Mr. Commodore.
The department would be agreeable to deletion of Subdivision 1.
Okay. So right now before us, we have Senator Rest's amendment to the Vandeveer amendment and Senator
Division, isn't it?
Senator, what's that?
I think it's kind of a division, isn't it?
Let's just do the amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Vandeveer.
Parliamentary inquiry?
Yes.
Could we move to amend the amendment to the amendment?
No.
No, you could not. Tertiary amendments are not allowed.
Okay.
So we have the Rest amendment before us
Mr.
right
Chairman,
now.
Maybe Rest. The easiest thing would be to divide the amendment, and I would divide the amendment at between lines.
2.17.
213 to 217, which in effect would be, if we move to do that, delete that, that would get rid of subdivision 1, and then we could vote separately on subdivisions 2 and 3.
Okay. As the author of the original amendment, Senator Vandiver, you get to choose which side we take first, subdivision 1 or subdivisions 2 and 3. Which would you like to take up first on the deletion?
Subdivision 1 would be, I think.
Okay, subdivision 1. So, members, right now we are, Senator Rest had moved to divide the Vandiver amendment, so now we are, the question before us is the first half of the Vandiver amendment, which is a deletion of subdivision 1, lines 2.13 to 2.17. To that amendment, Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Rest, I would just ask you to consider looking carefully at subdivision 2, because really, that is saying that breaks must not be accumulated in order to dismiss the class early. That seems very prescriptive, and I'm wondering if in your amendment you might consider, I understand about subdivision 3, but you still, Senator Rest?
Senator Bonhoff, if I could, that would be on the next second portion we could discuss
okay.
that.
All right.
But let's just take that first portion.
Again, We would not see anything like this if we didn't have abuse after abuse after abuse.
And Senator Rest, we'll take up that on the second portion of the amendment.
You know, I would not be.
Okay. So right now we have the first half of the Vandiver Amendment, which is before us, which is to strike subdivision 1. Any further discussion on that portion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sparks.
Did the department say they're supportive of that?
Yes.
Yes, they did.
Okay.
Okay. All those in favor of the first half of the Vandiver Amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. And the motion prevails, and the first half of the Vandiver Amendment is adopted. So subdivision 1 of section 5 is stricken from the bill. Now we are on the second portion of the Vandiver Amendment, which is lines 2.18. to 2.26, or subdivisions 2 and 3. To that amendment, Senator Rest, did you want to speak to that?
Not
or
anymore.
You didn't? Okay.
No, I think it's clear.
Well, then, members, I guess I wanted to make a comment on that, and I made some a harsh criticism of the value of continuing education, and I still hold those views. But I get what the department's going after here, and that they are attempting to make it more meaningful. And so, to that end, I guess I can't fault them for that. So I would oppose the amendment to strike subdivisions 2 and 3. Is there any further discussion, Senator Vandiver?
Mr. Chair, and I don't have quite your harsh view on the continuing ed. I think it's valuable, and overall, you know, it can have a good effect on the profession. But I will say that I think that treating professionals for the most part can be trusted. They're there. Most of them go for a reason and get their classes and do it honestly, and I think to base the whole system on the assumption that that's not what's going to happen, I think we should take a different approach is all I would say. And I was just wondering, is there a way to divide the second amendment? Is the second?
Senator Vandiver, the answer to that is yes. It could be divided. It is divisible between lines 2.21 and 2.22.
I would like to divide it between, leave subdivision 2, or move to have it, the result be, however we would do that, is to take out subdivision 2 but leave 3.
Okay. So Senator Vandiver has made a motion to divide his amendment between subdivision and subdivision 2 between lines 2.21 and 2.22. Senator Vandiver, which half did you want to take up first?
The
subdivision 2 section on breaks. That would be lines 2.18 to 2.21, and the Vandiver motion is to strike subdivision 2. Is there any discussion? Senator Rest.
Well, once again, I think if we're not going to use the definitions that and by getting rid of subdivision 2, and so I would oppose the Vandiver amendment to delete it, then I would say that we need to go back and delete sections 1 through 4 because they're just definitions without purpose.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I am speaking in favor of removing subdivision 2. You know, I had
have to go to continuing education as well. And, you know, we're big people. If we want to work through our breaks and there's a break authorized, then, you know, I don't think somebody should mandate that kind of stuff. It's ridiculous on the continuing education as well to force people to go to school to learn stuff they should be learning on their own anyway, just to have some kind of control. And so government can figure out their classes and government can approve the stuff that is ridiculous. And in my business, it's interesting that all my continuing education only happens while I'm in the legislative session, so I can't go to it. And by the way, in my profession, you should only have it in the summer when you can actually get outside and actually do hands-on to what kind of work you're doing. So it's a little ridiculous how government does it anyway. And they may be doing this, but to put it in law makes it much harder to undo it later if we disagree with it. So I don't even look at most of this as a technical bill. I think it's, well, I won't say what I think it is, but I support the Vandeveer.
Senator Chamberlain, do you have any comments on the Vandeveer motion to strike subdivision 2?
No, I'd support that piece.
Okay. Other members, any other discussion? Senator Daines.
I would oppose the amendment, and the reason for that is I think that when we look at these classes and we all go to them and we don't have the breaks on a scheduled time, pretty soon you have people moving in and out of the classroom all the time, disrupting the classroom. And myself, I think that the breaks are there for a reason, and I think that it makes for a better class, and I would oppose the amendment.
Mr. Chair. Parks. Can I ask Senator Chamberlain if he's glad he carried this technical bill?
Mr. Chair and Senator Sparks, I will direct them towards you next time. Thank you.
Mr. Commodore.
Mr. Chair, again, on Section 2, the breaks, this is lifted right from a number of educational suggestions. For classes of any type. Again, this is uniform across the states, and this language exists elsewhere in our statutes as well. I really think that we need to have this, but.
All right, Senator Jungbauer.
Well, final comment on the uniform across the states. Well, maybe we should be uniform in Minnesota, start the habit of having less regulations in the statutes and letting grown-ups decide what they need and what they don't need and when they need to leave the room and when they don't need to leave the room.
And Mr. Chairman and Senator, you should know that we, in fact, did lessen the requirements last year. The last 2 years, we have lessened the requirements for continuing ed, again, to be uniform. We dropped from 30 hours to 20 hours for this. So we have tried to lessen that in the past. But as long as we still have some, we're trying to make it set the standards so everybody understands who they are and make it easy to regulate. And again, we know that we have some bad apples, and that's what regulation is for, is to try and address that conduct. And we're asking that you give us the tools to do our job effectively.
Okay. Senator Vandeveer renews his motion, the first half of his amendment, which is to strike subdivision 2 of section 5. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No. The motion does not prevail.
Division.
All those members who are in support of the Vandeveer motion to strike subdivision 2, raise your hand. Okay. And all of those opposed? And the vote... The vote being 7 in favor and 4 opposed, that would mean that the motion does prevail and subdivision 2 is stricken from the bill. Okay. And on the final piece of the Vandeveer motion, which is subdivision 3, lines 2.22 to 2.25 on the verifiable self-study
Mr.
courses.
Chair.
Any discussion on that? Senator Vandeveer?
Withdraw that amendment.
Sorry?
I would withdraw that amendment.
And that is withdrawn. Okay. Senator Brown.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question on Section 5, Subdivision 3, where it says a self-study course must not be approved unless it is objectively verifiable that it includes a closed book end-of-course examination. How does one objectively verify that if I'm sitting on a computer at home that I'm not looking at a book on my end-of-course examination? I'm just wondering how we objectively verify that.
Mr. Commodore.
That's a good question. And the test questions are based upon the material that is presented in the course, the electronic self-study course. Typically, it's not going to be available in a book, one individual book, and there are timing mechanisms on the test itself so that conceptually you would not be able to run to your library and find the answer and do that.
So, Mr. Chair,
Senator Brown.
Thank you for that. So you're not looking at changing how you currently do it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, that is correct.
Thank you.
Okay. Members, any further questions on what's left of the Chamberlain bill? And I'm not going to even pretend to ask a question about multiple peril crop insurance adjustments. Somebody from who knows something about that wants to answer those questions. But seeing no further discussion, I'll ask, is there anybody in the audience that would like to speak either in favor of or in opposition to this bill? Yes, Senator Benoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could somebody just explain the pre-existing condition, how that relates to the new federal health care law, and what the thought is of having that in this bill in this place?
Yes, I am Tina Armstrong from the Department of Commerce. I'm the Director of Healthcare Policy there. This section about pre-existing conditions, this is within the AMCHA statutes, so it's strictly applying to the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association. And what it does is already AMCHA has situations where the pre-existing condition exclusion is waived, and several of those just never got updated and cross-referenced within the AMCHA statutes itself, so this is purely technical. And it's literally, there are the other subdivisions that say 3A and 4E say when you're coming off of a state public program and you go into AMCHA, the pre-existing condition exclusion in AMCHA is waived. So it does not relate to federal health reform.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Vanderveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think this is a technical bill, Mr. Chair. I have a question on you're requiring a license for real estate closing agents on 8.5 through 8.9. Change there. Could we get, and then I have a couple other questions actually that would, there's some other changes in legislation that was put in place by Senator Scheid and myself last year. So I don't know how much time we have, but it's starting to look like it's.
Well,
anyway, section 8.5 through 8.9.
Mr. Chairman, would you comment on Senator that? Vanderveer, we believe this is technical in the fact that. Last year, you'll recall that we had a bill that reorganized Chapter 82, and inadvertently, the licensure of this was removed from there and not placed in the appropriate spot. So this just puts it back into the form that it should have been in the beginning.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Vanderveer.
823 to 824. Removing the extension for appraisers. Could you explain what that issue is?
This one, appraisers, for the temporary appraisers, there was the existing law, as you see, was 6 months with an extension. That extension was pretty much automatic. It was pretty much always asked for. So here we're just changing it to a 12-month at the beginning.
I see. And one more question, Mr.
Senator Vanderveer.
Maybe my other one would be answer to this one. 828 to 833, is that correcting something with regard to the 922 part?
I'm sorry. Could you repeat that? I'm sorry.
Sure. On page 28, appraiser pre-license education through, huh. And then on page 922, you're taking out old language and putting in some new, is that?
Yes, this was just, again, we believe this is purely technical. The language exists in under the experience in 82B14. We think it properly belongs under the education piece because that's where everybody would be looking at it. So we believe that that's technical. It's just moving it from one spot to another. It's not creating new law.
Thank you.
Senator Vendor, so you're comfortable with the technicalities? Okay.
I was a little distracted by the continuing ed for a minute.
Senator Dames.
If the commission could explain on page 8.1 through 8.4 on the crop hail, how has that changed from the way it was previously stated? What are the changes?
What's happening here is, again, 2 years ago we passed the new model laws regarding adjusters, and at that time there was an exemption being proposed for those people that qualified for the multi-peril under the federal program to get an exemption from some of the education requirements, and it was not in a final form at that time. It is now, and we had always intended to allow the people that exemption, and we're now trying to make that happen.
Okay, thank you.
And this is something that industry has definitely asked for. And we know of no opposition. Everybody's in favor of this.
Okay, thank you. Senator Chamberlain renews his motion that Senate File 1045 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the general orders. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed say nay. The motion prevails and Senate File 1045 is as amended is passed and recommended to pass and sent to the general orders.
Oh no, yeah, just
thank you, members, and the committee is adjourned.